webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
Well, we'll see if I'm here. Well, at least I sound all right. That sounded like it was coming from Max Headroom someplace. So somebody has hit a button somewhere and turned on the reverb, which, since we don't sing here or use electric guitars, is sort of irrelevant. So y'all might want to look for that while I can. Yeah, we are Aomen of Borg. That's right. That would have sounded good. Yes. Drop your shields or you will be assimilated. That would have sounded, that's how they did it. Okay, well, we figured that out. Anyway, hey, today on the program, I want to start off first and foremost by mentioning that some of you have seen the banner ad we've had up for quite some time now at aomen.org, God's Wrath of Redemption, the John 10:16 conference in New York, August 4th through 5th. I have been given information that if you have intentions of attending, and I am to be there along with Michael Horton and Vadi Balcom and Leon Brown, plus other speakers as well, now would be the time to let folks know about that. I need to get in touch with them and get registered for that. I believe that possibly the cost is going to be going up fairly soon as well, and doing that kind of thing in New York is a bit of a challenge to begin with. So it would be very helpful to them to have an idea of what kind of support is available there, how many people are going to be coming as far as making plans and so on and so forth. So I would encourage you to be with us for God's Wrath or Redemption. I'm going to be looking forward to hearing from people like Michael Horton and Vadi Balcom and things like that. So I'm going to get a chance to get ministered to in the process, which is a good thing. So, you know, and y'all can put up with my preaching every once in a while if we absolutely have to. That's August 4th through 5th, 2010. In New York City, there is someone playing around with cars out in the parking lot down there. Just thought you might want to know that. That's what I was pointing at. we have security cameras here. They're walking off now, which is good. We were watching someone playing around. We've actually watched someone on recording heisting a truck out of the parking lot, which it did not take them nearly long enough, unfortunately. The guy got it back, what was left of it, after it was used to desert run illegals across the border and all beat up. I think it was stolen again, wasn't it? I think that one was stolen twice. Yeah, it was obviously a very comfortable truck for driving across the desert. So anyway, that's why we keep an eye on things out there in the parking lot. Today on the program, I have something queued up. We were told that certain folks might be calling in, but I did want to address a few issues. Some of you may have noticed that the AP story, actually a follow-up AP story on the Ergin Canner scandal, appeared on Fox News yesterday. When Fox News has it, you know, between all of their stuff about, you know, what a Hollywood star just got, you know, a facelift and all that important news that Fox News tends to have out there, when Fox has picked it up, then it is all over the place. The irony was the whole story was about how the supporters of Ergin Canner are disappearing. I felt like writing to the reporter and saying, I know where they are. They're right behind me. Okay, I know exactly where they are, and they have not fallen silent in any way, shape, or form. You know, I don't know if I've been told lots of things. My email box is a very interesting place these days. And it does make me wonder if someone may not be monitoring all email being sent from liberty.edu to domain name aomin.org. it does make me wonder. But I have been told that there has been a very concerted effort on the part of Ergun Canner's supporters contacting pastors all across the United States, attempting to create a groundswell of support for Ergun Canner. And I don't see that happening. I think a lot of folks who takes more than half an hour to just sit down and do some reading and some watching, just watch some videos. It would take you a lot longer than that to actually even begin to review the amount of information, just reading through the court documents and the stuff that's been posted, and it would take you a long, long time. And I understand that a lot of people don't have that kind of time to invest. But the fact is, if you just spent that amount of time, I think that's why there's silence, because you just have to go, oh boy, well, what's the response to all this? What's the answer to court documentation that someone lives in the United States in 1969 and their own words? More than once now, we've documented that Ergun Canner said that. Yeah, I moved here in 1969. But then he also said he moved here in 1978 and 1979. And he's telling two different stories to two different groups of people. Someone that he figures can check him out, he tells them the truth. Gullible Christians from the pulpit of a church he tells a different story to. And that's the whole issue. So the information is right there. But I was thinking this morning about something. I have tried as best I possibly could to try to bring some positive things out of this situation, something edifying. People have commented, for example, in the video that my brother Isam and I did on Ergun Canner and Arabic. I tried to insert into that things that would be helpful for people to understand and know. It wasn't just, see, he messed that one up again. Not even close on that one. Not even close. Tried to discuss some of the, you know, the backgrounds. I've had a number of people comment that they had thought, you know, I hadn't even thought about the fact that you would expect to hear unique elements of the Arabic language coming out in what someone's saying, if they're even attempting to speak Arabic, that there are letters in Arabic that do not exist in English, and pronunciations do not exist in English as well. And you'd expect to hear those things, and that's not what you hear. Instead, you hear what you normally hear on TBN, you know, when someone is trying to give proof that you need to be sending in $69 based on Psalm 69, and they start speaking in tongues to demonstrate this is the case. And so, you know, that's how you handle it. So I tried to insert that kind of stuff, tried to get something positive out of this entire scandal in the process of actually dealing with the issues. And so this morning I was thinking about the fact that if you go onto the Veritas Seminary website today, you will see two big banners. You know, they look like something you put up in your church or something like that, for Bible conferences this July. And the thing to note about both of them is that one of the speakers in both is Ergun Canner, along with people like Norman Geisler and Ron Rhodes and people involved in apologetics that are a part of Veritas Seminary. And I started thinking about, you know, where are my fellow apologists in this situation? Where are the discernment ministries? Where are the people who can go through all sorts of historical documentation demonstrating that this cult leader and that cult leader was wrong, and they make those conclusions on the basis of significantly less clear and compelling information than has been provided in regards to Ergun Canner? Where are all those folks? I remember once in Philadelphia, I was at a conference. This was prior to the writing of Chosen But Free and The Potter's Freedom, and so it was back when Norman Geisler liked me. And it was between 1994 and 2000 because he was making reference to the King James Only controversy. He says, James, you go get those King James Only folks. We're right behind you. We're a long ways behind you, but we're right behind you. Well, that's humorous, but it does sadly seem to address something. And as we're why is it that I sort of I'm not alone? They're you know, Turretin fan and Jason Smathers and the squirrel up in Montana. there are a few of us, and a few Southern Baptists here, there, and everywhere. But in general, it seems like they don't want to rock the boat. And it's sort of like, well, we'll let you do that, James. You go ahead now. You make yourself a pariah forever. And I sort of wonder because, you know, sometimes you look back at when movements got started, and the Christians at that time didn't seem to be really quick to pick up on things and, you know, speak the truth when it needed to be spoken. And that causes a bit of a problem. And so one of the thoughts across my mind was, okay, these presentations with Veritas Seminary are taking place in July. Allegedly, we are going to have some kind of a result from the Liberty Seminary investigation, Liberty University investigation by June 30th. What if they come out and say Ergen Kanter has been lying in churches? What if he's no longer the president of Liberty Seminary come July? Will he still be speaking at those conferences? Will the results of the inquiry be clear enough to address whether Ergen Kanter is an expert on Islam or not? And if he is, what's the basis of it? Is it solely the fact that he wrote on the Crusades? A fact that I've brought out many, many times, of people like Peter Lumpkins don't listen to everything that I say. They just, you know, very selective. Is that it? Or is it not clearly obvious in his own presentations that his claim for expertise in regards to Islam is his upbringing as a Sunni Muslim in Turkey, Ankara, over on the border with Iraq? Now, a couple things crossed my mind at that point. The first that I think is really important, and I'm sort of criticizing myself here, and I've got lots of people who have been joining me in that of late. Why is it that Liberty University is being seen as the final authority in this matter? I mean, certainly in regards to whether Ergen Kanter should be the president of Liberty Baptist Theological Seminary, yeah, Liberty University is the final authority on that, for obvious reasons. But I simply have one question to ask all of my friends and those who are not my friends in the audience, and that is, where's the church here? Where's the church? Where's Thomas Road Baptist Church? I believe, in fact, in the introduction to what we were playing in the pre-feed, I believe that he is a member of Thomas Road Baptist Church. I think that's what exactly was said in the introduction. He didn't correct that. So where's Thomas Road Baptist Church in this? Now, see, a lot of people automatically go, well, why should they have anything to do with this? Because we have so eviscerated the authority of the church in evangelicalism. The Thomas Road Baptist Church, most evangelicals go, well, why should they be involved?
Folks, it's because they have a member of their church that has been standing behind dozens and dozens of pulpits and lying to the people sitting in front of him.
Oh, but he wasn't teaching falsehood about the Trinity. He wasn't teaching much truth about it either, but he wasn't teaching falsehood about the Trinity. You know, these are just exaggerations. Come on.
And what it seems to me is that we have had a glaring light shown upon the evangelical world and its view of the pulpit. One of the things that I really, really appreciate about the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church is that we protect the pulpit. I have seen three people other than the elders of the church or members of the church, but I wasn't there for that one or I would have been preaching. So for me, and I've been a member there since 1989, so right at this summer would be 21 years. I have seen three men other than the elders of the church ministering in that pulpit. Jim Renahan, Albert Martin, and John Skaggs. Those are all ministers, but those are the only three that I've seen. I don't remember anyone else. I really don't. There may have been some others, but I would have been gone at that time, possibly. I don't know. The reason for that is not because we think there's nobody worthwhile or anything else, but we believe that the ministry of the Word of God from the pulpit before the people of God is the central act of worship of the church. One of the things that Rich and I were talking about recently, and I've talked about this before. Ironically, the first time it really bugged me was at a conference in Chicago where I was speaking and so was Norman Geisler. But the praise leaders, the singers, would get up and say, well, we're going to have some worship before the speaker comes. So in other words, in their mind, the worship was the music. The worship was the singing. The worship was the lifting of the hands and the lifting of the voices. And then when you're done with worship, the guy talks. And I couldn't control myself. It bugged me so much that eventually, after one of the sessions, before I started, I simply said, I just need to say something. You know, I appreciate what these guys just did. They're very good. But we aren't done worshiping. In fact, may I suggest that this is when the real worship starts. And I use this phraseology in my prayers when I lead the pastoral prayers at the church. Lord, help us do the work of worship. And so it just seems to me that while it is important for Liberty University to deal with the problem they have in the president of their seminary and his myth-making, his documented myth-making, Liberty University is not the final arbiter of these issues. Even if they do the right thing, and we hope and pray that they will, even if they are completely open and they really do answer all the questions and they really do bring all the facts to bear, which we hope and pray will happen, all they can do is deal with Ergen Kanner, president of Liberty Baptist Theological Seminary. They can't deal with Ergen Kanner, man behind pulpit, minister Ergen Kanner. That's Trinity Road. Thomas Road Baptist Church. Was I saying Trinity Road before? Anyways, Thomas Road Baptist Church. That's where it should be being dealt with. Why isn't there an investigation there? The authority and the duty of the church to safeguard the purity of the proclamation of the gospel and the handling of the Word of God is part and parcel of the issue here, but no one even seems to be thinking about that.
I mean, I've said from the beginning, this is an integrity issue. This is an integrity issue. But it's an integrity issue within the church. And yet, so few even care about that. One of the things that has offended me so much about so much of the lying that has gone on in defense of Ergun Canner, the ad hominem attacks against me, think I'm the issue here when I'm not the issue at all. But one of the things that has offended me most is people have said, well, you know, you're just doing this because he's an Arminian. Let me tell you something, folks. If Ergun Canner was reformed, I would have been significantly rougher on him than I've been. Because I would hold him to a higher standard. Not only that, if he was reformed, I actually could have gone to a church with a biblical authority structure to address the issue. I could have gone to the elders. But you see, in so much of evangelicalism and in Baptist circles, there's no biblical view of the plurality of elders. There's no biblical view of the protection of the pulpit. The pulpit has become something, then let's face it, many churches has disappeared because there's no room for it in front of the band. It's been replaced by a guy in jeans and a graphic tee who wants to relate to you, not to proclaim to you the word of the living God. And don't get me started on that. But I really think that, this is one of the major issues here, and it's been missed. Where is the church in this? Where is the church in this situation? I can't seem to locate it. Can't seem to find it. So whatever happens with the inquiry from Liberty University, however it comes down, either the right thing, factual, full, open disclosure, all the issues dealt with, which we can hope and pray for, but I'll be perfectly honest with you, I'm not holding my breath. Or if it's the worst thing that can happen, a full-blown cover-up, well, what Ergun actually meant was he became a naturalized citizen in 1979, And the Dukes of Hazzard. he was talking about Daisy Duke and how she's hot, you know. Yeah, and behind a pulpit. Hey, it was just a little bit of exaggeration, a little bit of theological leverage there, you know. Which will only result in 2020 and Nightline and all the others beating a path down to Lynchburg, or somewhere in between. Whatever the result is, unless the church addresses this, it will not have been addressed. That's why, did you all see the thing? What was that guy's name? He was the head of the big evangelical thing, and he got caught with having had Ted Haggard, you know, 3-year-long relationship with a gay prostitute and all the rest of his stuff. He's starting a new church. And people sit around going, why? Why? What are people looking for? Are there so few good churches left that you, why? There is massive ecclesiastical ignorance in evangelicalism today, and this situation is demonstrated. We were playing as our pre-feed, let people know that we're on and we're feeding and so on and so forth, a portion of a sermon from January 23rd of this year by Ergun Canner. It is 98% entertainment. It's telling jokes. It's telling stories, the same stories and jokes we've heard over and over again. You know, sometimes a little bit of a twist. Very well delivered. He's very good at his timing. He is an excellent speaker. But there wasn't enough theology or Bible in it to keep a hungry saint alive. And I've listened to a lot of these things, and others of you have listened to more of them than I have. I don't have time to. And it's always the same thing. You tell some stories, you get people laughing, you go the text for about 3.5 minutes. You throw some Greek words out, and then it's back to the stories. And that has become accepted as pulpit ministry. And the results we see all around us. The results we see all around us. That's... There you go. So where's the church? Where's the church in all of this? That's what needs to take place. There needs to be... Thomas Rode needs to stand up and do what a church needs to do. No matter what Liberty University does. Am I going to hold my breath on that one? No. No. But we could hope and pray because that's what needs to take place. 877-753-3341. I'm going to stay on topic here. Jordan, we'll get to you. Just hang with us. But I want to stay on topic here. Let's talk with David. Hi, David.
Hey, Dr. White.
How are you?
I'm doing good. I just want to say thank you for being out there and doing this. And you are on the right side of history.
Yeah, the problem is when you're on the right side of history, you're normally dead before anybody finds out about it.
Well, I mean, you mentioned like 2020 and other secular news organizations. I really feel this thing's on the cusp of blowing up that big.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm glad you used the word liar. I don't know if you used it before, but today was the first time that you used that word, at least that I heard of. And that's what it is. I mean, there have been exaggerations and misrepresentations, but... just straight up a lie. I mean, if you say that you debated Shabir Ali and you never even met with the guy, that's a lie.
Well, not only said it once, you put it in a particular location, and now you refuse to say who it was you debated in that location because you say you misspoke. You said it a second time and connected with Abdul Salib, someone you know is not in fact a Muslim. It's all this stuff coming together. And then the thing that really got it for me, because, you know, I have honestly, Ergun seems like a likable guy in many ways. And so
yeah.
I have tried to recognize it. I've tried to put on to the side what happened in 2005 and 2006. I've tried to look at the information. But here's the problem. We have two instances, a Turkish interview and the 2002 AP story. Where at the very same moment we can demonstrate Ergun Kanner was traveling the country, staying behind pulpits, saying, I was raised in Turkey, son of an Islamic scholar, and I came here in 1978 and 1979. At the very same time he's saying that to those people, to the AP reporter and to the Turkish newspaper, who can check if he knows Turkish or Arabic, he came here in 1969. He knew that he was telling two completely different stories at the same time. I don't know how anybody can look at that and go, oh, you know, just mixing things up. Just mixing
right.
things up. It's not possible.
Well,
it's just
one,
not
one
possible.
Dimension, I don't, you touched on a bit, but I feel sad for some people in Lynchburg, and that's his family.
Oh, of course.
He's a family man. I mean, he's married and he's got kids, and I just cannot. I mean, that's just shameful. And they've got to know. You know what I mean?
Well,
he doesn't come home speaking Arabic, you know what I mean? And they've been around him enough. I mean, you mentioned his brother. He's got to know. And I'm just wondering, what are these people thinking? Because, I mean, not only is it morally wrong, anybody, you wouldn't even have to go to a believer. You could go to a non-believer, and they're going to tell you don't do that because it doesn't work. You talk to people enough from a pulpit. You know, you're on YouTube, and you're... many, you know, multiple times, you're saying you can speak Arabic and Turkish and possibly other languages. You're saying you're meeting with all these people and you never have. Eventually, that's going to get out there and you're going to get caught.
Eventually. Eventually. I see, that's common sense, but be honest with you, I cannot imagine the mindset of standing in front of an audience and saying these things when you know that what you're saying is not true.
Right.
Cannot conceive of this.
I'm scared to try to pronounce Arabic words, and I know those are the right words. I mean, I don't know Arabic, but the few times you drop it in there, I'm scared to do that.
Sure. Well,
to get it wrong.
Well,
I'm not even going around telling people I speak Arabic. I'm just saying, like, the few times that you might, you know, say, like, Isa or Allah or something,
right.
And then you just say, shouldn't I just stick with the English words? And in fact, if he had done that, he'd actually be in less trouble. He's trying to throw these Arabic words out there, and he's not even using them
correctly.
But see,
all of it is, and this is one thing that, again, if someone calls in today, maybe we can have a discussion on this, but there are people who have defended him who, in essence, have adopted what I call the theoretical avalanche approach, and that is, theoretically, if you could plot the course of every single rock in an avalanche, you could move out of the path of any single rock. But avalanches do not come one rock at a time. And what people have been doing is they have been failing to see the cumulative effect of all of these issues. They're saying, well, you know, maybe he rushes when he speaks, and that's why we can't understand his Arabic. We understand his English just fine, and he allegedly learned that from the Dukes of Hazzard. I mean, come on. Let's say you come up with a plausible explanation of one fact, but then you go over here and three different times you say Ramadan is 40 days long,
right?
Then you go over here and it's avalanches come.
I think it's pretty clear that he's borrowing from pop apologetics to Islam, like some of the issues he touches on, like one that I even caught. And that Muhammad Khan, it was mentioned in the one that's Arabic. He's got like about 50 different ones on YouTube with different titles.
Right.
And the one that you played, and granted he was focusing on the Arabic, but when he talked about who Abraham in the Quran sacrificed on Mount Moriah, and he says Muslims say it was Ishmael. And he even said that the Quran says that. And no, it does not. I even knew that little bit, and I could catch it that fast that it's left ambiguous. And so later, Muslims have gone back and they've debated amongst themselves, was it Ishmael, was it Isaac? And actually, there's varying traditions on that one.
That's...
But he buys into that whole, I guess you could say, pop thing, kind of like with the striking women that's mentioned in the Quran.
Well, yeah, and that's what I tried to bring out and got my head handed to me on a platter when I pointed out something that Emir, a canner, had done in just accepting a particular interpretation of Surah 4:157, the substitution view, and not even mentioning that there's all sorts of reasons not to think that that's what it's actually talking about. He presented it to his audience as if, well, the Quran says that somebody else was put upon the cross rather
it's
than
the only one. Yeah,
exactly.
When there's differences in Islam,
all sorts of
that,
different views, and so it was that kind of thing that again made me raise the question: why is it that people are going to churches and these men are standing in front of us and claiming to teach Islam? As far as I can see, the whole thing is their story. And so if the story isn't true, then you have a real problem here. So,
one thing that I don't know, maybe it's an issue that I have with you on this and because I'm trying to fill this thing out. One thing that was said, and I don't know if it's accurate or not, is when this was coming out, Aragon and his handlers or whatever, they came out with this information that was like, oh, yeah, well, I am a Muslim. Here's why. And my dad, he's from Turkey, and he's a Muslim, all this. And you were saying, and you were right in saying this, well, not right, but the gist of what you're saying was right, is that no one's saying that he's not ever a Muslim.
Well, I was saying the Christian critics of Aragon Kantor have not ever, to my knowledge, have never said that he was not a Muslim.
Because
it's Muhammad Khan that said that.
I believe we're saying that because, again, the guy, the YouTube videos that you post, the one who's bringing this out to you, it appears that that's what he's saying. And to be fair, I don't fully blame him.
Oh, no, I don't blame him. I just think that the evidence is overwhelming that Aragon Kantor's father was clearly a Muslim. The court documents bear out the fact that there was a dispute between Aragon Kantor's mother and his father as to the continuing education of the boys in Islam. There's not even a question about that.
Right.
The whole point is, before they were 10 years old, he was out of the house. And they were raised by their Swedish grandmother and by their hippie mom. That's using Emir's description. She became a hippie.
Right.
So there's no evidence of this jihadi training, living in Turkey,
yeah,
and
Cairo,
all the rest of that, Cairo and Beirut,
whole,
and blah, 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 blah.
The whole
you
nine,
know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
so that's the problem.
I know that. The reason why, I mean, when I like the video you put out that said, you know, that a disbeliever, an unbeliever can at times speak something that's truthful.
Of course.
And one of the reasons I could see, and I'm kind of playing devil's advocate here, is that where some people, you know, they're a little bit skittish at taking a Muslim at their word or believing.
I know.
Is the fact that there have been, to be honest, on YouTube and elsewhere, Muslims who have lied about former Muslims that have become Christian.
No question about it.
I mean, the one that's in my mind is Walid Shabbat, and that they were saying all kinds of false things about him. They never doubted that he was an Arabic speaker, an Arab, but, you know, that they said he was Christian flange and all this, and that, and the documentation was there that he was who he said he was, and they still didn't want to believe. Said false things about Jay Smith.
Right.
You know, they do that on YouTube, and so to me, it's almost an opportunity to put it back on a Muslim. Is I would say, well, you know, Muhammad and the Quran is about as knowledgeable as Christianity, as arrogant as Islam. They get it wrong all over the place. Even these guys you've been putting on your website, you know, who was it? The one of the guys that was debating?
Gerald Dirks?
No, he was one of the Muslims, and he was saying this stuff was in Greek. He's saying all this Greek was saying this. He doesn't know Greek, and he was getting it wrong.
I'm not sure which one you're referring to, but yeah, look, we have over and over again.
What I'm trying to make is that they're getting it wrong all over the place. Ahmed Didat would say stuff that wasn't true.
Exactly. Ahmed Didat was just as bad with some of his mispronunciations as Eric Cantor was. But we have tried to be consistent. I have over the years criticized the people they have on the Dean Show who claim to be former Christians clueless. Who are clueless about what Christians believe.
I'll even go a step farther. Is they're so clueless, and they claim to have been in such a high level of Christianity, like a pastor, not just a normal congregant, that it really does doubt if it is true.
Well, not only that, it's sort of funny, but because you have former youth ministers, and deacons, yeah, and they're being turned into experts. Well, David, we're sort of agreeing with each other on a lot of that stuff there. I hear you.
The one issue, though, that
real quick.
Has anyone put out the idea there of, okay, going to Eric Cantor and saying, you know, okay, look, brother, you're lying, clearly, but you are a brother. If you will come forward with this and be honest, you know, maybe on our end there's some grace and there's some compassion, and, you know, maybe you don't have to get kicked out of liberty, maybe not, we don't know, there are consequences, but, you know, maybe we can help your family. I mean, I would like to see that kind of thing, that we're not just trying. I mean, I'm
well,
not saying that you
Dave,
are
David,
saying that.
Well, David, I posted a plea to Eric Cantor at least 2 weeks ago. It is in his hands to end this today.
Mm-hmm.
If
you're right.
If he wanted this over with, and it could be over with today, because the fact of the matter is, he's the one who, by his silence, has in essence, incubated this entire situation.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me that if he lived in Turkey up until 1978, look, I can sit here right now. I'm a little bit older than Eric Cantor.
Uh-huh.
And I can tell you my kindergarten teacher was Mrs. Sullivan. My first grade teacher was Mrs. Miller. My second grade teacher was Ms. Ashinger, even though she got married right at the end of the year and broke my heart because I was in love with her. But and I
you
went
remember
to.
That?
Yeah. And I went to Ross Moyne Elementary School, and
right.
I lived at 501 St. Mark's Road and 301 St. Mark's Road and 5 Belmore Road in Camp Hill in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. I remember those things. He could tell us, what street did you live on in Ankara?
Mm-hmm.
Where? What city did you live in? Put us in contact with your relatives that could testify they saw you there. That's not difficult.
Right.
He could prove his story.
His cousins and whatnot in Turkey.
Exactly. He could prove his story today
right.
if he wanted to, but he is the one keeping this going. Don't throw this on me.
No, he has.
It's
Ergen Kim. He's pulling other people into his sin. I mean,
It
seems pretty clear to me that, I do think he's conscious of what he's doing, but there does seem to be a level of, I guess you could say, compulsion. But these other people that are defending him, I'm like, why are you doing that? I mean, it's just...
Oh, it's denominational cronyism is what it is. It's tradition,
man,
it's sad. It's sad. It really is. David, got to run.
Right.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks for calling. God bless. Bye-bye. And real quickly, let's talk with Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hi. You asked a question as to where is the church in this? I
right.
figured out one of the answers to that is that after 9/11, Islam was a threat. We needed an answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
And he came out, and he had, at that time, a semi-plausible story.
Mm-hmm.
He rose to prominence upon our ignorance, essentially.
Well, let me go a step beyond it. I'm afraid it's not just ignorance. There's also a level of bigotry in it. There really is. I mean, let's be fair. We wanted to hear the worst we could hear. And there's lots of bad stuff in Islam. But the problem is that perspective ends up making Islam a monolith. And we don't like it when people treat Christianity as a monolith. We want to be able to make sharp distinctions. But when it comes to Islam, we're not allowed to make sharp distinctions, evidently. And unfortunately, it does seem to me, because I've experienced this. I had a young woman from Liberty communicate with me and say, well, I bet you for the mosque at Ground Zero because you're all chummy with the Muslims. And the mindset of that just leaves me stuttering. I recognize there are Muslims that are extremely untruthful. But I also recognize there are Muslims that have tried to be as honest as they possibly could be in light of their beliefs in every communication we've had. I have to allow those things to be real. And it seems to me a lot of Christians want to just simply have a very simplified, all the Muslims are like this. I don't want to do the work of recognizing the differences that exist between Muslims. I don't want to do that. I just give me a nice stereotype. And unfortunately, let's face it, one of the things that has been extremely offensive from the first time I met Ergun Canner is that he has been willing to use racial stereotyping constantly from behind the pulpit, talking about towel heads and sand bleeps and stuff that is extremely offensive, and he uses it behind a pulpit, and people buy it up. They go, great, that's wonderful. So, yeah, I think that's also why you have, when he talks to reporters, saying one thing, but when you're talking to a bunch of Baptists at a big old megachurch, I guess you can just say whatever you jolly well want to say and not assume anyone's going to catch you on it. And that says a lot about, says a lot about the church today. Steve?
I've had 4 years of hanging out with Muslims and international students at the college I just got out of, and one intro Islam course, and I look at the videos that Muhammad Khan put together, and I see more errors in them than Muhammad Khan points out. Like, when he's talking about divorce, I mean, it's, to me, the perfect example of him playing to our stereotypes. Muhammad Khan missed this. Your Arabic tutor, I've forgotten his name, it escapes me.
Hisham.
Also missed this when he's talking about divorce, when he says all he has to do is face Mecca and begin, he begins with a gross mispronunciation of Allahu Akbar. He rushes it so badly and has a habitual mispronunciation of one Arabic letter so that it renders it unintelligible unless you realize that he's playing to the fact that we, American Baptist people, think that all Muslims start all of their prayers by facing Mecca and saying the takbir.
Well, I don't know that we can identify what he was trying to say. I don't know that he was saying Allahu Akbar, even if he was, because I've heard him say that pronounce that correctly. So I don't. It sounded to me, honestly, Steve, like he was saying something other than that.
I was rushing so badly.
Well, but you know, every time, I mean, every single time he allegedly says something, he's quote unquote rushing. I think the reason he's rushing is because he's making it up. You know,
just this one.
I'm sorry.
It's just this one that he's rushing.
And
it's not that he's making up a word. It's that he's forcing intentionally the wrong word into a context. So, and he knowingly is misusing proper Arabic just enough to lend himself credibility to people who don't know.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to disagree on that. I don't think he's familiar with the actual terms personally, but that's okay. But, you know, the point is that the church is going to have to address this issue, or it's just going to continue festering, and it's going to continue causing division, and that's not a good thing. Steve, I've got other callers to get to. Thank you very much for your phone call today, and thanks for listening to The Dividing Line.
877-753-3341 is the phone number. 877-753-3341, and that's the number that Jordan called quite some time ago. Sorry about that, Jordan, but wanted to keep the topics somewhat consistent. Jumping back and forth can be a little bit confusing, but Jordan over in the beautiful land of New Mexico. Actually, did I see that you guys have already started getting a little bit of the monsoon flow, some of the afternoon thunderstorms already over there?
Yeah, we had a pretty crazy one a few
could
days
you,
ago.
Could you keep that over there for a while, please? I'll try
to hold it down.
Because once that gets over here, it becomes, at least you have some altitude. You get some relief. Once it hits us here in the deserts, oh, it's just horrible. So anyways, those of you who don't know what we're talking about, don't worry about it. But I watch the flow coming up out of Mexico, and it goes into New Mexico first. But then when it starts moving west, that's when our dew points get up, and it gets ugly over here, really ugly. What can we do for you, Jordan?
If you like, I'll speak to the clouds and try to keep them from coming on over. But yeah, that works out for me. I just want to say that I really appreciate the program. I've been a long-time listener, and I feel like everything that you've been talking about recently has kind of been revolving around me. I'm an ex, I guess I'm an alumni of Calvary Chapel Bible College out in Marietta. And I don't know if you remember your debate with Bob Wilkin, but I went to his church when I was down in California.
So, oh, okay.
I just kind of been seeing all of this kind of develop around me, and it's been pretty amazing to watch some of the things that have been said. And being a student, you can't exactly come out and pick a side, if you would. But I just wanted to let you know it's been a total blessing. I've been following all the videos on YouTube and just really learning a lot.
Oh, great!
And
what brought you all the way over to New Mexico, though? Are you in a church there? Or?
Oh, I actually got married about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Where she lives. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Oh. I did two weddings weekend before last, so about 2 weeks ago, interestingly enough. So, yeah, I performed two weddings, so it's, I don't know, I'm starting to feel old when I realize that these young kids I'm marrying are about the age of my kids, and it's like, oh, brother, man. So, anyway.
It's a little scary when time crawls up on you there.
Oh, it'll, believe me, it's crawling up on you too.
I'm still in denial.
Yes.
But anyway, I just wanted to ask a few questions or maybe just kind of give you leave to go where you want here. But I'm just newly reformed, especially kind of developed that theology as I was at Bible college, ironically enough, just started looking at what the word said instead of taking preconceived notions that I had grown up with.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, limited atonement is not really something that you can mention at that particular school without really becoming a pariah yourself, you know? And,
yes.
It's kind of like the four-letter word of Bible college.
Well, that and James White. James White and that, those would be about the same, yeah.
Right. I mean, I've been in class at times where I was thinking about asking because it kind of came up, but I've actually had teachers throw out the word heresy with conversation like that. So I figured it'd be better if I just kind of sat in the back and didn't really ask that question. But I was hoping you could take just limited atonement and talk about it as it's discussed in the book of Hebrews, because I've been hearing you say a lot about how it's clearly taught there,
right.
But I've been having trouble really developing that just because, I mean, I'm new to the book of Hebrews, and I've got a whole bunch of preconceived notions and churchology coming up in the church. So if you could just go at that.
Sure,
however you feel like it.
Well, a couple things. I think you might be able to find, I know I have given this presentation at some churches. I don't remember if it's on sermon audio or whatever, but I know I've given a presentation on particular redemption, especially out of the book of Hebrews. And, of course, right now, I am preaching through Hebrews, so I will be preaching right at the end of June and then twice in the middle of July. And Lord willing, I'll be in Hebrews for each one of those as well. And I'm now getting into the real meat of that section, and in Hebrews 7 especially, which we'll be starting in the next sermon. So we have now, and for those of you who, this is sort of a general announcement, for those of you who have been upset with our real audio website at prbc.org and the fact that there hadn't been anything posted there for a year, I have signed up a sermon audio, and so our stuff will now be appearing on sermon audio, including the sermons and Bible studies, and I'll be uploading a Bible study from John chapter 10 that I did yesterday or Sunday morning later today. So anyway, so there will be more there, and I would really direct you to those fuller explications. But just to lay it out in 6 minutes, 7 minutes, which I have here at the end of the program, fundamentally, the beauty of the presentation of particular redemption in the book of Hebrews is found in recognizing the beauty of Christ as sacrifice, as high priest, the two together. He is not only the sacrifice, but he is also the one offering the sacrifice, and hence he is the one who then, having obtained eternal redemption, goes into the holy place, and he offers that, and he becomes the intercessor, the one who intercedes. When we see the Old Testament backgrounds, when we see the presentation that is made of the work of the high priest, where on that Day of Atonement, he not only offers the sacrifice, you have the shedding of the blood, but that's not all. He then, it's not a separate work, it is the one work of the high priest. He then has to take that sacrifice to the place of atonement, to the place of covering, and he sprinkles that blood upon that holy place. And only he is able to go in there and do that. That is part and parcel of the one work that is his on that Day of Atonement. And the writer of the Hebrews takes that as his primary argumentation, that the pressure being placed upon these Hebrew Christians to go back and offer sacrifice, to, by offering that sacrifice, deny what Jesus did, deny that he was a final sacrifice. He develops that from 7 all the way into the middle of chapter 10. So there's a whole section there, and he develops it along different lines. At first, he develops it along the line of the high priest, and because he has an indestructible life, he is able, according to Hebrews chapter 7, to save forever, or to the uttermost, those who draw nigh unto God by him, which would be the particular people there in the Old Testament. It wasn't the Babylonians. It wasn't the Egyptians. When the high priest went in, he represented only those people who drew nigh to God by faith to worship. It was a particular audience that he was propitiating their sins. It wasn't even all the people of Israel. It was only those who drew near to worship. And since he enters into that place and he has an indestructible life, unlike the old high priests who have to keep going in and out, they can never offer a perfect sacrifice, and they can never intercede perfectly because they are prohibited by their fallen nature and by death. He, having conquered death, enters into the very presence of God himself, the Father, and since he there provides a perfect sacrifice, then he is able to save to the uttermost, seeing he always lives to make intercession for them. That recognition of the relationship of sacrifice and intercession is what makes the beautiful presentation of 7 through 10 so powerful. But then he picks up, especially beginning in chapter 9, on this idea of the repetitiveness of the old sacrifices. The fact that every person who drew nigh unto God in worship in that Old Testament, Old Covenant context would remember that they had done this before. And the high priest, this has blown me away to consider this, the high priest, think about what it was like to be the high priest. You go in, and let's say you are high priest for 20 years. You go in on year 18, and what do you see in the holy place? No one else but you has been in there. For the past 18 years, only you are in there. What are you going to see? On the place of atonement, you're going to see the dry, crusty blood of every offering that has been made before this one. And you're going to remember having sprinkled that blood. And the whole point of Hebrews is it's imperfect. It becomes, as Hebrews chapter 10 says, an anamnesis, a reminder of sin. Sin has not been removed by this. This is a shadow, a foreshadowing of what is to come. And so the fact that it is this repetitive sacrifice points to the fact that there is coming a day when there is going to be a single sacrifice. And that's the point of 9 and 10. He enters into that holy place having obtained eternal redemption, not a partial redemption, eternal redemption. He enters in, and by that one will, that one covenant, he perfects for all time those for whom that sacrifice is made. So we take this high view that most people miss because it's based upon the Old Testament. Let's face it, most evangelicals today are canonically challenged. They don't know anything about the Old Testament. They don't know anything about the sacrifice. You know, that's all that blood stuff. Let me go read in the Psalms someplace, something like that. And so they miss the fulfillment language that is found in the book of Hebrews, in the work of Christ as high priest, as intercessor, the one who is both the offerer and the offering. They miss all of that stuff. And so as a result, the text that gives the clearest, longest, didactic explanation of the purpose and intention of the atonement is missed. And in its place, what most people have is an emotional doctrine of the atonement, a traditional doctrine of the atonement that simply doesn't fit. It's the idea of Jesus making it possible for us to be saved. By his atonement, he makes us savable, rather than Hebrews chapter 7 telling us he is able to save to the uttermost. And so there's the contrast that ends up being drawn as I drive people to that text and say, listen to what the argument was. This is what the writer thought would be so effective to keep people who are under such tremendous pressure to go back to the old ways, to deny Christ. What would they find to be, in those glorious words of chapter 6, a sure and steadfast anchor for the soul that goes into the holy place and is unmovable? Jesus, who has gone in as our forerunner. What are they going to find to be that kind of beautiful, proper foundation that will stand up against that pressure? The finished, perfect, sacrificial work of Jesus Christ that perfects those for whom it is made. That is that sure anchor that is given to them in the book of Hebrews. How's that?
Thanks. I appreciate it. Yeah, that's perfect. And you said those the sermons that you're going to be giving are going to be on Sermon Audio?
Yep. In fact, I'm going to be going back and getting all of them from the beginning, from Hebrews 1, and uploading them over the next couple of weeks. And so the whole series will be available there. And then as I'm preaching them, they will be posted as well. Most of them are on YouTube right now, on my YouTube channel. But we'll be putting on Sermon Audio as well.
Great. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks for saving, hanging on there, Jordan. Thank you. God bless. Yep. And congratulations again on the wedding.
Thanks.
All righty. Bye-bye. All right. Well, there was a 6 or 7 minute sermonette right there at the end, which is good to get a chance to do after the topic, the necessary topic that we had to deal with before that. Keep praying for us, folks. There's a lot of folks that would like to see us silenced as we try to speak on these subjects. But as God gives us freedom, we are going to continue to press on. Lord willing, we will see you here on Thursday afternoon. See you then. God bless.
Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again this Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. for The Dividing Line.